No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Or we have a chat box and you can send a question there. We've got two very special guests tonight. The first one is Brooke Pinto. But first, let me introduce my co-host, Maria. Maria, how are things in California?
Pretty much the same, Michael. Thank you. Winter garden is flourishing now into a spring garden, keeping me sane. And my PhD studies keep grinding on. I should say my dissertation. I'm done with the classes.
Well, good. Yeah.
And what about the brown COVID household?
Well, we're okay. We sent Mary back to college. And
did you?
She has an apartment up there, and she's gonna resume work, I think. She doesn't like taking her courses on the internet, but that's a discussion for another day.
Okay.
Today we have Brooke Pinto with us as our first guest, and Brooke is a candidate for public office. She's a candidate for the city council in one of the hottest contested races, probably the most hotly contested race in D.C. For the Ward 2 city council seat. I've endorsed her. If you listened to the program a few weeks ago, you heard Attorney General Carl Racine was on the show, and both of us have endorsed Brooke. And, after we talked to her for a few minutes, I think you'll see why. Brooke, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you both so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be with you here this evening.
Thanks. And let's start out with the most obvious question. Why, Brooke? You're 27 years old. You had a great job with the Attorney General. Why do you want to get involved in this craziness of running for public office?
Right. Oh, the age-old question. So as you note, I was at the Attorney General's office. I was there first as a tax attorney, where I was representing the D.C. Office of Tax and Revenue. And most recently, I was the Assistant Attorney General for Policy and Legislative Affairs. And so in that role, I was working with the D.C. Council on a daily basis, both on legislation that they were considering, as well as legislation that originated out of the Attorney General's office. And I was always really most inspired by those pieces of legislation that we weren't just advancing a vote, either in favor or in opposition of something, but really being part of crafting a tailored solution to a problem, to incorporate all the various diverse interests at stake and making sure that a contemplated legislation was really workable, implementable, and enforceable. And I really always loved that process and thought there was a lot more to be done. And then at the end of January, when the council was set to unanimously expel Jack Evans for the first time in council history, and 5 minutes prior to that vote, he resigned from the council. 1 week later, he announced he was running again for the same seat. And I frankly just couldn't really believe the flagrant disregard for the rule of law. And so a week later, I resigned from my job and got in the race. And I think it's great that we're having the topic tonight of women in politics, because I think so often so many women who are thinking about it stop themselves and say, well, am I really ready Do I have the experience I need? Why don't I wait a little bit longer until I know everything there is to know? And as I looked at this crowded field, I thought to myself, well, despite being the youngest candidate in this race, I actually have more relevant experience working directly for the DC government and on behalf of district residents than any other candidate running. And so why not me? Why not now? So I'm thrilled to be in this race, and we've had a lot of really exciting momentum, especially in the last month or so. And so we're feeling really excited and hopeful and confident going into these last few weeks.
And the Washington Post endorsement. I mean, how wonderful that you're getting, well, the senator and the attorney general and the Washington Post. That, how does that feel to you? I mean, not everybody gets the kind of kudos that you're getting right out of the gate.
I mean, I feel incredibly grateful. You know, this has been a great experience being able to speak with so many people, both voters and institutions and small business owners and current politicians. And I'm really happy that I've been able to connect with so many of them. And I think at the end of the day, this is all really a service business. And those people who understand that, that for those of us really seeking public office to provide excellent service to our constituents and really move our city forward are coming on and supporting our campaign. So I'm extremely grateful for that recognition and hope to make all of those supporters proud, and I'm confident I will do so once on the council.
Well, and you know what, Brooke, that's really the reason that I endorsed you, is that after having a talk with you in Iowa, where we got to talk for about half an hour face-to-face, I really got the sense from you that you were in this for the right reasons, that you were in this because you felt that it was a place where you could make a difference, and you understood the responsibility that goes with the office. And that really bothers me as an elected official, that we have members of the city council who see it as a vehicle to promote themselves instead of feeling that responsibility that you talk about. And that, I agree. I think that's the most important thing, is to feel that responsibility to the people that elected you, because it's an honor to be there, and you should cherish that, and it should always be your motivation. I think that people have put you there to help them, and it's an honor to be able to do that. Let me ask you, there was an editorial in the paper yesterday which said nice things about you. Everybody's saying nice things about you. That's great. But they talked about ranked voting. For those of you that don't know what ranked voting is, people can rank their votes. So if that nobody gets 50% of the vote, there can be a runoff among people who came in second and third on people's ballots, basically. Not a great idea, in my opinion. But in this race, where there's so many people, what do you think of that, Brooke? Do you think there should be ranked voting?
Yes, I do. I think it's a great idea. We've seen it implemented in other jurisdictions that have found great success with it. And particularly in these local races, when especially when there's so many candidates, everyone's kind of becoming a pundit. And so people are thinking, not only who do I want to vote for because they're the candidate that I'm most excited about, but who can really beat the person I don't want to win? And that type of punditry on behalf of the voters, I think, can be dangerous in a field that is basically impossible to poll. There's so many of us, and there's traditionally low voter turnout. And so I would, A, advise and ask that the voters who are excited about our campaign, or really any campaign, that they vote for the candidate who they want to be their representative, as opposed to the candidate who they think may have the best chance of winning due to data that happened prior to me even getting in the race. But me aside, I do think ranked choice voting is a great idea and something that we should absolutely implement in the district, because it has been demonstrated to improve democracy in the democratic process.
I asked for clarification, since I'm unfamiliar with that. I live in Los Angeles, Brooke. if somebody votes for you but puts as their second choice one of your opponents, do they run the first round without paying attention to the ranking? And then if there's no clear 50% person, then they go back in and tally the ranking?
Yeah, so we can set it up in D.C. a couple of different ways, but that's generally how it works, is that you vote for your choices in order of rank, and then as they're collecting the votes, they split it into rounds. So the voters don't have to go back and vote a second time, but they will cut off the people who received not enough votes in the first round, and then they'll go back another time and see if there is a clear winner that is at least closer to a majority as opposed to the plurality.
Does your registrar do that?
The Board of Elections would be responsible for doing it in D.C.
Boy, that sounds tedious.
Well, it is. And let me also add that we have a problem with the Board of Elections. And let me ask you about this, Brooke, if you've got anybody in your campaign that's keeping an eye on this. I, for example, went online to get a absentee ballot almost 3 weeks ago. I have yet to receive my absentee ballot, and I went online because you can check to see what the progress is. And even though I have a confirmation from the Board of Elections that says they received my request and that they are, you know, they're processing it, when I went online and checked, they said they've never heard from me and they have no idea what I'm talking about. And, you know, so is there somebody in your campaign keeping an eye on the Board of Elections? Because I'm sure that I'm not the only person in Washington, D.C. who's not getting an absentee ballot.
Do you think? That's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. And only 65% of the people that voted as of Friday, the people that have voted in the previous election, have even applied for ballots in Ward 2. So what are you guys doing about that? Do you have somebody in the campaign keeping an eye on that?
Oh, yes. We are very concerned about this. And in the immediate term, we do speak with the Board of Elections on a daily basis. And we have so many people who have told us, including on our own team, who have applied for their mail-in ballot and there's no record of it and they haven't been able to find it. Now, we are told by the Board of Elections that they were prioritizing, just for time purposes, not an actual priority of vote, of course, those applications that came in via online form, and that afterwards they'll be able to process all the applications that came in through the other options, through the Vote for DC app or through fax or through phone. And so we're hopeful that once the cutoff deadline, which is May 26th at 4:45 p.m., for those of you listening who need to order your mail-in ballot for the primary election by that deadline, once that deadline happens, the Board of Elections will have an extra week to get organized to send all of the ballots out to those households who have not yet received them. So they seem to be confident in their process. I think that they need much more staffing over there as a general matter, even prior to this situation, but especially now, we need to get some more staffing and training into the Board of Elections so that we can implement this process more smoothly. And I think in the long-term basis, we should really be sending every voter, every registered voter, a mail-in ballot in the first place without having to wait for them to request one.
Absolutely. I don't even understand why we can't vote by mail. I mean, I'm sorry, vote online, since they require my Social Security number in order to send me a ballot. I don't understand why that's not sufficient for a vote. But anyway, it's good to know that somebody's keeping an eye on it. I think it's ironic that a guy whose single purpose in life is to make sure we get a vote is the guy that can't get an absentee ballot.
Well, it's good in one way, Michael, that you're experiencing that, because you know that it can happen firsthand, not just from hearsay. But it's terrible that it's happening, because how many people might be disenfranchised from the process?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or don't follow up, or don't know who to call.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, Brooke,
It's a complicated process to be going. Go ahead, Maria.
Have you received much pushback about your stance on decriminalizing cannabis?
Interesting. I have not. A few people who have voiced to me their concerns about a full legalized regime, once I speak with them about this really being a criminal justice issue to me and a states' rights issue of allowing the District of Columbia to implement our own voters' wishes in the confines of our own jurisdiction, people seem to understand that approach. As you know, the arrest rates for cannabis use and possession are completely disproportionate nationwide. Black men are 4 times more likely than white men to be arrested. In the District of Columbia, 93% of our arrests for cannabis use and possession are of black men, and only about 48% of our population is black. And so that is really a priority of mine, is making sure that we are not so disproportionate in our response, but that we can also provide a safe environment for people to utilize, in many cases, their medicine.
You know, one thing that I need to ask you, Brooke, I'm sorry. Obviously, I'm technologically challenged. I touched my phone by mistake. But anyway, let's talk about statehood for a minute. This is my issue. I know that you've advocated for it. My position is that last year the D.C. government gave out 70 times as much in grant money to arts and humanities as they've given to statehood advocacy. We put hardly any money into this. We don't support the people that have been elected go up to the Capitol Hill, go up to Capitol Hill and lobby for us. What do you think about that? Would you, if you're on the council, would you be interested in putting more money into our effort to become a state, since we just lost $755 million by not being treated like a state? How do you feel about this? Should we be putting more of an effort into this?
I think it is the most important issue. If we want to most effectively represent, as I do, the residents of Ward 2, and in your case, the residents of all of the District of Columbia, we have to be able to have autonomy and legislate within our own border. And so until we have statehood, we will never be able to really do that. My first priority is to get the additional $755 million of immediate relief funding that we need to address COVID. That is the first most imperative thing that we have to do as a jurisdiction in order to get relief to our small businesses and build up the resiliency in our hospital and healthcare systems and make sure our teachers are trained properly to provide online distance learning. All of those important programs and addressing affordable housing and our transportation challenges, none of that can happen adequately until we get the additional relief funding that we need from the federal government so that we can also maintain the long-term financial health of our city. And so that is absolutely my first priority on the council. And I completely agree with you that we have to really focus on this. I was very disappointed to hear another one of my candidates yesterday in an article. He was trying to undermine, I believe, my endorsements from you and Senator Blumenthal from Connecticut and Congressman Kennedy from Massachusetts and now former Senator Tom Daschle. And his point was, that's really not the responsibility of a council member to try to get that funding or to try to get statehood, which in my view is a real kind of abdication of responsibility. As a staffer working for Attorney General Carl Racine, I thought it was my responsibility to make meetings on the Hill and to ensure that I was meeting with Republican senators and building those relationships and making the case, whether it had to do with privacy legislation or cannabis legislation or statehood. And at every conference I ever went to across the country, no matter what the topic was on behalf of the attorneys general, I always started with the conversation about statehood. And I think that it's really incumbent upon our leaders at every level to take that responsibility really seriously and to put the required effort and funding into that effort so we can really start moving the needle. And this is no longer something we talk about for if we're in the future, one day.
Well, okay. After that answer, my only regret is that I can't endorse you twice.
Well, yes, you can. For the primary election and then for the special election.
Oh, that's right. Well, thank you, Maria. I would do that.
Let's let the listeners know what that means, because June 2nd is one thing, and you have to be a Democrat in order to vote for you, but June 16th is another thing, and you don't have to. So why don't you share with our listeners the distinction and that they should vote twice?
Well, thank you so much for that opening. That's a great point. So, yes, there are two elections this year. So one is the election that was always scheduled. That's because the Ward 2 council seat was up for the 2020 election. So that election is June 2nd, and that's for the Democratic nomination during the primary election. The winner of that election goes on to the November general for the four-year seat starting in January 2021. Separate and distinct from that, there's a special election because, as I mentioned at the outset, Jack Evans resigned from the seat to avoid a unanimous expulsion. And so there is a vacancy right now. We don't have a representative right now as our city is facing the greatest crisis of our generation. And so there's a special election on June 16th, and the winner of that will fill the seat just for the remainder of the term, so from June until January 2021. And so we're really hopeful that we'll be able to win both elections because we think continuity in that seat is so important as we're working to rewrite many of the budget priorities for this year and next year. And so it's really important if you're going to order your mail-in ballot, which is the safest way to vote, and we recommend it, despite Senator Brown and I just talking about the inefficiencies of the Board of Elections office, it still is the safest way to vote. To order your mail-in ballot, but make sure you order them for both elections. And so the easiest way to do that is there's an option at the top that says order your mail-in ballots for all 2020 elections, and we would recommend you do that. And if I may just say, there are two voting locations going to be open in Ward 2 on the election days, and those are at One Judiciary Square and Hardy Middle School. And early voting starts May 22nd, so you can vote in person if you must, from May 22nd to June 2nd. Otherwise, we would recommend you order your mail-in ballot.
Can you turn in your mail-in ballot to the polling place also?
Yes.
Okay. We can here in California.
Let me ask you, Brooke, if you win the election, which we all hope is going to happen, and Jack wins the special election, does he get to run in November as the incumbent? No.
So it's a great question, but in that exact scenario, so Jack Evans actually recently pulled out of the special election.
Oh, he did.
So he is no longer running for the special. He is just running for the primary.
What if somebody else wins the special election?
They would have to run as a write-in candidate, I believe, because whoever wins the primary will be on the ballot as the Democratic nominee. And there is one Republican running as well, on the primary on June 2nd. So whoever wins that primary will be on the ballot in November. So if it's a different person who wins the special, which is possible if not everybody orders both of their ballots at once, then that person would have to run as a write-in candidate, I believe. I was recently advised that you can't switch your party status mid-cycle, meaning because we're all running as Democrats, if someone else won the special election, I don't believe they could switch to running as an independent. So they would probably have to run as a write-in candidate in November.
It's such a bizarre system.
It's very.
Bizarre. And the bizarre nature is that if Jack Evans does win the primary election, there's still an investigation open, and there's the possibility that his colleagues vote to expel him again. And would that mean there's another special election costing the taxpayers another $1 million? I hope not.
Right. It's crazy. And why wouldn't his colleagues vote to expel him? What has changed? You know what I mean? The circumstances around what he did haven't changed. I mean, if he won, I would imagine, I think what they would do would be to hide behind the voters and say that the voters have decided. But what they should do is expel him, which is what they were going to do originally. Mm-hmm. We're running out of time here because we're going to have a second candidate on, another young woman. Make sure everybody has your website, Brooke. You want to give us that so that people know where they can get more information and, more importantly, where they can give you money. Give us your website.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It was really a pleasure to chat with both of you, and I look forward to doing this all in person once we're able and return to normalcy a little bit. But that would be great. So my website is www.brookepinto4ward2.com. That's brookepintoforward2.com. And on the website, we have my 10-point COVID relief and recovery plan. We have more of my platforms, from criminal justice to transportation to the environment to senior care and housing, laid out there. And we would love to hear from you. And if you reach out through the website, it comes directly to my personal email as well. And we do office hours every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7. And you can sign up for those on my website as well, or email community@brookepinto4ward2.com for the Zoom link.
Let me, before we let you go, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that looking at your website, I saw that one of your field organizers is a young woman that grew up with my kids. Rose Edelson and my children all went to school together. So a shout out to Rose. You're obviously hiring good people. And this is a young woman very worthy of your support. So if you're out there listening, make sure you plug into her website, see what she's about, because she really deserves your support. And thanks for being on the show, Brooke.
Well, thank you so much. And that's so great to hear. Yes, Rose has been an incredible asset to our team, is so organized, so responsive, really a brilliant addition. And we've made sure to do that across our campaign, to hire really wonderfully qualified, thoughtful, smart, kind women. I was the beneficiary of many mentors throughout my career, and I'm really excited to have such a strong team of women behind us. So thank you so much for your support and for having me on.
And you're just beginning,
Brooke. Yes, and you know what? It really shows that, that last statement really shows that you understand what this is all about, too. It's all about making the community better for everybody, promoting people, and making D.C., keeping D.C. the wonderful place that it's been for so many years. So thank you so much, Brooke, and we hope to have you on our victory show sometime in June when we talk about what you're going to do once you get on the council. Thanks again.
Congratulations. Absolutely. Brooke.
Would love that. Thank you both. Have a great evening. Happy
continued
okay.
success. You too. Thank you, Brooke.
Okay. And Doug, do we have Janice with us?
Hello?
Hello, Janice.
Hi.
Is that you?
Hi, this is Janice. How are you?
Thanks for being on the show. This is a little disjointed.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Senator.
Yeah, and you know what? I understand, before we go any further, that your grandmother was the lunch lady at Deal Middle School. All my children went to Deal. My wife was the librarian at Deal. So we love Deal Middle School, but this is my first question to you.
And I'm a Deal graduate, too.
You are. And where did you go to high school? Can I ask you?
School Without Walls. I went to School Without Walls for high school.
Yeah. Anyway, before I let Maria ask you a question, let me ask you this question, because it's on your website, and I think this is so important. You're going to represent Ward 4, but we have such a terrible problem with education in the District of Columbia. It breaks my heart that when I was first elected, 51% of the kids at Anacostia High School did not graduate on time. And I just found it so absurd that you would say to kids on the first day of school, you've got less of a chance of graduating than you do of not graduating. What can we do about this?
Yeah, I think it's so critical. And actually, you know, some of the work that I studied at St. John's University actually led me to do a city year, an AmeriCorps program that we have here in the district, but across the city, which actually goes to address the dropout rate and making sure that kids don't drop out. And what we found is that the factors that City Year used were reading score, math score, your attendance and behavior. And students who had low indicators in three of those areas were more likely to drop out than others. And so what we did at City Year Corps members is actually get there, identify those students, and then work all year in classroom, after classroom, and before school to get those students' factors down and to be able to get them from not graduating. And so it's that level of intentional intervention that we have to do on a grand scale when it comes to education. And so, you know, here in the district, what we need to do when we talk about equity in education, one, we need to look at the way we budget our schools and the allotment of funding based on enrollment, because enrollment isn't the only factor. We have to look at socioeconomic factors that impact the schools and the unique factors that impact each individual school. So we have to create a budget that's based on equity. We also got to invest in our teachers and our educators. It's so important that we start looking at why we have one of the highest rates for teachers leaving our system, because when we don't have teachers staying, we can't, it's not a school that, you know, is able to succeed. And then we also had administrators leaving because they were getting very short contracts, like one-year contracts. So when you have high teacher turnover, high administration turnover, and you're basing enrollment on budget on enrollment alone, you're really leaving schools at a place where they're going to continue to starve and not be able to address students in education. So it's going to take a really multifaceted approach in making sure funds actually meet to the at-risk students. Here in Ward 4, we have a large English language learner population. We have to make sure the funding for those students get there, and that the teachers that need to be there actually are funded to be able to be there. So, you know, my work as a City Year Corps member, you know, really helped me understand working in an underserved school and getting students back on track to graduation really let me see how all of these factors come together from budgeting to teacher support to administration support. We all have to be on the same page as a community.
That's a great answer. And you just got Mrs. Brown's vote, who was the Deal librarian, but is now a librarian in Fairfax County for much of the reasons.
And we have to save our librarians. We just had an issue this year with some of the schools losing their librarian techs. And we were fighting to make sure that, you know, librarian technicians and librarians stay around. So there's another budgeting issue that just came up this year.
Oh, my God. Now Mrs. Brown is going to make me move to so that the two of us can vote for you. Go ahead, Maria. Ask a question.
I do want to ask Janice, having grown up in Ward 4 and now running to represent Ward 4, how surreal is that for you, or is it?
Oh, it is just unimaginable as to the shock that I received. Earlier in the campaign, we started knocking on doors, and I was knocking particularly in Shepherd Park, and in like one day, I knocked on my first grade teacher's door. Her husband answered, and he said, oh, you grew up here. Where'd you go to school? I said, Rudolph Elementary. He said, you know, Miss Kimbrough? I said, yes, my first grade teacher. And then she was like, he called his wife, and she came to the door. And it was the first time I'd seen my first grade teacher probably since first grade. And then I knocked on my other door, and it was my Howard Law professor who lived in the community and was what my constitutional law professor at Howard University Law School. And then I literally knocked another door, and it was my doctor. And so it's just been so surreal to really knock doors in Ward 4, because I'm running into, you know, so many people who are really, who have impacted my life and been responsible for, you know, me being able to reach this point. But it's been, I knocked my high school vice principal door, my first grade teacher door, my doctor's door. It's just been, you know, really surreal. And some of my, you know, best friend's parents' doors. And so it's just been really surreal in that way to have those doors knocked and to be able to have those conversations.
And while I've run campaigns, and I'm a full believer in knocking on doors, and I know Michael is too, with handshakes and greetings and signatures and everything else. But that must be, I mean, you're, talk about on the shoulders of those before you. Here you are showing people that you came from the community, you care about the community, you're still invested in the community, and you want to represent the community. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Absolutely, absolutely true. And, you know, for me, I actually started my advocacy really young. I, you know, went to Rudolph Elementary, and then I went to Deal for my junior high school. And really, that first opportunity of just kind of, there was seeing, you know, there was a difference in, you know, the quality, I think, of education and the quality of the school. And it was the first time I started looking at equity in education, and that led me to actually run for school board. So I actually served on the school board as a student representative during, and this was Superintendent Dr. Janey was the superintendent, and Peggy Cooper Kafritz was on the school board, and William Lockridge, Tommy Wells. I mean, so it's just so, you know, for me, it seems a lot of the issues that I am really running on are issues that kind of, you know, stuck out to me as a young person, and things that I, you know, was worried about, like as far as housing and displacement. You know, I spoke about it, you know, my sister sent me an article from 2006, Washington Post, where I was like, you know, I'm so worried about my grandmother being able to afford to stay in the city, you know, with the property taxes going up, and just like, here we are, here, that was in 2006, and here we are some 14 odd years later, and that's a reality where we have to protect our seniors and make sure they're able to stay here, and the cost of living is getting to a point where, you know, they're unable to do so. So it's just been really interesting to kind of see, you know, some of the things that I fought for as a young person really are still remain issues. And I still need to have to stand up and really fight for those issues. And so it's been interesting to really see that and to be able to, you know, have so many mentors and people that I look up to who are supporting me in this campaign saying, I'm so proud of you for standing up and really being a voice for our community and coming from a place of having lived this experience and knowing what it's like.
And your prescient warning, if you will, from 2006, that's 14 years ago. I mean, talk about a visionary. Wow, do you have a crystal ball for other things?
No.
hate to break up this love fest, but let me ask you about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, COVID-19. For reasons that I don't understand, and perhaps you can explain this to me, Ward 4 has the highest incidence of COVID-19, of people that have actually been identified of having coronavirus. In fact, it's four times as high as my ward, Ward 3, which is the next ward over. You have four times as many cases, according to statistics released by the D.C. government on Friday. As we go to open things up, you know, this is the big issue now. They're opening things across the country, and we open things in the city. Should we be conscious of the, you know, opening particular wards? In other words, should Ward 4 be the last ward to open?
Yeah, you know, I think a number of factors have played into Ward 4's high numbers. One of those factors, one includes obviously density of our ward and the high level of density we have as Ward 4. The other thing is we have one of the largest, if not the largest, actually senior population in our ward. We house the most seniors across our ward. We also, in addition to that, have one of the highest immigrant populations. We have a large Latino community, a large African immigrant community, and a large Caribbean immigrant community as well. And so we also have, you know, some access here in our ward as far as individuals being able to have access to health and being able to have the means to be able to get tested. So I think it's a combination of all of those factors that we've seen kind of high numbers in Ward 4, particularly. And I think what we're going to, you know, have to do as we look at that is figure out, you know, a lot of our workers are the frontline workers, right? So we're talking about our grocery workers, our healthcare workers, our bus drivers. You know, we have a lot of working class residents, middle class residents in our ward who still have had to serve during COVID-19. And so that's a factor. I think, you know, we're going to have to really think about how we reopen the city, and, you know, how we do it in a way that everyone's going to be protected. But I think, you know, for us here, in Ward 4, we're particularly focused on making sure our seniors are protected, have the transition that they need, and being able to make sure everything is completely safe, that the rates are at a low rate before we, you know, transition back to having our seniors in the community as they've been identified as the most vulnerable population.
What about your population, period? Is there a big disparity between the numbers between 3 and 4?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, total population.
Oh, no, yeah. I don't know. I think Ward 4 is a bigger ward.
Yeah, we're much bigger. We have a higher density than Ward 3. So when you look at the density numbers of Ward 4 and Ward 3, Ward 3 has a number of single-family homes. Ward 4 has a good number of single-family homes. We also have near our metro transit areas, so you're talking Georgia Avenue, Petworth, Tacoma, and Fort Totten Station have high-density housing. And so that contributes to our large population number.
Let me also ask you, as a former Teamster, why do unions love you so much? You've been endorsed by 8 unions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a product of union family. So my mom's a postal worker. She's been an American postal worker for over 33 years. She spent majority of her years actually serving right here in Ward 4. And she's still serving right now during COVID crisis at the Brightwood Post Office here in Ward 4. And so my mom was an active member of the American Postal Worker Union and participated, you know, in being a delegate. And so I come from a union household. So a lot of times when I talk to unions, I make it very clear that, you know, unions are the reason that my mom was able to, you know, have food on the table, clothes on our back, be able to have adequate healthcare access with my brother who had really bad asthma. So, you know, unions really support, you know, working families and working people. And so that story has resonated very well. And it's really the story I've had with, you know, talking to, you know, union members where, you know, they connect with my story in such a way where I talk about, you know, my mom being a postal worker and then us, you know, having the rent go up in our house twice and then go up a third time. And even my mom with the union job, you know, struggled for us to be able to stay here. And I had to take on, you know, a job, multiple jobs while doing law school to help her be able to remain here. You know, so when I talk about my experiences, union workers are like, I relate to that experience and we're experiencing that right now, especially during COVID-19. I mean, you know, the unions that I have been endorsed by, the healthcare workers, so 1199, SEIU, 500 SEIU, the Washington Teachers Union, our teachers, ATU, our transit, that's our bus drivers, right? And so, and UFCW, Local 400, which is our grocery workers, right? All of these members are having to work throughout COVID-19, and we've had to fight even now to make sure that some of them can be deemed essential workers so they can get childcare and free testing. And so I think they really connect with the fact that, you know, I come from a union household. I'm about fighting for unions and union families and working families. And I'm able to speak to their struggle from a very personal place. And I think they really want to see someone who's going to advocate with the understanding and perspective of coming from where they come from their perspective and being able to be a voice on the council in that way.
Well, I agree with that, and I got to tell you, I think that's very eloquently put. I ran a consulting firm for 25 years. We only used union labor, and I'm proud of the fact that I ran a small business where, you know, if somebody got sick, if one of my subcontractors got sick, they had health benefits. You know, they had little retirement funds. They had, you know, I feel good that for 25 years, I provided employment for union employees. And I should also tell you that I was a direct mail consultant. So I'm one of those people that has great respect for postal workers. Yeah. They do an incredible job. They really do.
Absolutely. And they're under attack right now, the post office is.
They're always under attack.
Administration. So it's a fight.
So this may surprise you, Michael. Janice doesn't, you don't know me, but I've been a member, union member of SAG-AFTRA for over 30 years. And I know it sounds like an oxymoron for what some of my beliefs politically, but I understand why they were created and why they still need to be, because of collective bargaining for starters. But I see that as nonpartisan myself. And it's lovely that you're able to speak. In other words, you're not just saying, I feel your pain. You know their pain. You've been through it. And I think that makes a difference to people, because you don't just have sympathy, you have empathy. You've walked that walk. Right. You know what that's like. You didn't get taught that. You weren't tutored about it. You've lived it. And that, to me, that's what means that you're relatable, you're electable, you're votable, you're likable, and also fighting for statehood, because I'm a huge statehood advocate, too.
Well, you know, I'd like to ask you about that. But let me also add, before we move on, that Janice has 24 endorsements. So it's not just unions that love her. Everybody seems to love her. That's very fun. I can't remember somebody that has as many endorsements as you have. So that's a really positive thing. But tell me, what do you think about statehood? We just asked Brooke Pinto. I know that you know Brooke. The two of you worked at, I don't know if you worked together, but you both worked at the Attorney General, who was just recently a guest on our show and seems to be the great incubator for political candidates in Washington. Both of you are running. And we just asked Brooke if she thinks, you know, last year D.C. put $14 million into grants for Arts and Humanities around the city, which is a good thing. But they only put $200,000 in trying to get statehood, grants for statehood. And we just lost $755 million in a single shot. Should we be putting more money and more effort into this, in your opinion?
Yeah, we absolutely have to. I mean, we've seen just now, we just saw how critical it is with losing $750 million during this crisis. And now, as a city, we're going to have to figure out how we budget to be able to make up what we've lost from not being a state. But, you know, for me, you know, I personally, growing up here, statehood has been taxation without representation, right, has, since you're a child, is something we know and something we've been fighting for. And I think, I don't know if Brooke mentioned it, but we have a particular issue at the Attorney General's office with the fact that, you know, our elected attorney general doesn't have a say over of how we handle a number of issues in our city, particularly when it comes to, you know, criminal justice issues, right? Whoever the U.S. attorney appoints, who's ever appointed by the president, kind of gets to have jurisdiction over, you know, how we handle criminal justice issues in our city. And so it really limits the power of the attorney general in that way. We also, you know, we see it also play out with the council when it comes to if we do have initiatives, you know, on the ballot and those initiatives get passed, you know, the voters of D.C. are already disenfranchised, you know, by not having a vote in Congress. So when we do vote on an initiative and it gets to, you know, the place where, you know, the Congress decides, well, we don't want that to happen, then they can tell us what to do, right? And so we just absolutely, you know, deserve you know, we pay federal taxes, right? We pay more in federal taxes, in fact, and then so many. So, you know, for us to not have statehood really is a huge issue, and it's gonna affect our governance and how we govern as a city until we really make the investment to fight back and really work across the aisle to get the votes that we need to be able to become a state.
Well, you just got another endorsement. You can add me to your list. And, you know, let me also say that people should know that Carl Racine is our first elected attorney general. As crazy as that may sound to in a city that's, you know, 219 years old, he was the first one ever elected. He used to be appointed. And we fought hard to get an elected. Our delegation fought hard to get an elected attorney general, just because we need that independence, and now we need to empower that person. Do you have a question, Maria?
Janice, Can you tell us what was your inspiration? Was it your mom and your grandmother, and you saw their struggles as women and or single heads of households, and that inspired you to move forward? Or was there a mentor? Or how is it that you find yourself right here, right now, today?
Yeah, I absolutely am going to say, you know, my mom and my grandmother, right? Both who... one of the, you know, values they instilled in me, I always say they instill the values of hard work, of education, but most importantly, remembering to lift as you climb. And the idea of lifting as you climb is no matter how far you get and being able to, you know, break some of those ceilings. I'm the first in my family, first-generation college student for my family. I then became the first lawyer in my family. And so navigating, obviously I had mentors, but I always kept the value. My mom said, lift as you climb, lift as you climb. So no matter, you know, where, you know, how far, you know, you go in life, you have to remember everyone else around you. And it's about lifting up your community at the same time. So, you know, I came through, you know, was able to succeed through education, and I recognize how important education is, going from Rudolph to Deal and School Without Walls. And I want to make sure that there are other young people who can have that same quality of education and they're not left behind in that way, right? And so, you know, my family struggled with housing and not being able, you know, being worried about being displaced and pushed out of our house and me having to have jobs to help my mom be able to do that. So I'm absolutely going to go back and, you know, and help families who are struggling to survive in that way. And so, you know, it's that value of remembering that, you know, as we grow as a city, you know, as DC has become more prosperous, that prosperity has to reach everyone. And that value is particularly is the value that really has brought me to this moment today.
So as a tag to that, Michael, just if I may, I don't know if you know or not, Janice, but I just finished it. Melinda Gates' book is entitled The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World. And it might
I
be
did not
something,
know that.
Yeah, it might be something because she talks about when women do better, the community does better, the economy does better, the family does better, the country does better. And she gives example after example after example globally. And it's really something that you just happened to use that word, and that's in the title of her book. And it was fascinating. It's a great read.
Well, and you know what?
Absolutely.
That should mean.
I mean, so many issues we face here in D.C., you know, really are, you know, predominantly like, you know, women issues. So we talk about, you know, we have one of the highest rates of mortality for Black mothers in our city, right? In it's in the country. We have one of the highest numbers of mortality, you know, for Black mothers in the country, and that's a health issue. But we have to make sure that we have women who are, you know, having voices who are going to say, no, we can't have this. Let's figure out how we get adequate access to all mothers in the city, and that they're able to be able to get the treatment they need. And when they say they're not doing well or they're sick, that's taken seriously. When we talk about, you know, jobs and wages, we have to understand that a lot of the service industries, when we talk about who are our teachers, who are our nurses, our healthcare workers, our child care workers, predominantly even grocery store workers, all of these are predominantly women-dominated fields. And so when we talk about having, you know, a fair wage, it directly impacts women. We talk about funding birth to three for all. You know, that's something that's so critical because we need to have the funding to support our child care workers. And also it's supporting families at the same time. So everything that we do, you know, really from health to housing to education, directly impacts women. And if we take care of women, we know that women take care of the community, and the community is better as a result.
Yep. That's as she mentioned, true. Too, family planning is a big one. And contraception versus after the conception. But because when women can plan their families and space their children and have them with deliberate intention, that empowers everybody as well.
Yeah, and let me say the same thing to you that I said to Brooke, Janice. I think that you're in this for the right reasons. I think that, you know, in just this brief time talking to you, I can tell that you know, you're doing this for the right reasons, and you have your priorities straight, I think. I came from a family much like your family. We were always broke. I dropped out of high school at 15 years old. The most brilliant person I ever known in my entire life was my older sister, who was the first person in our family to go to college and actually was a tax attorney. So, you know, that's how she started out, as a tax attorney, but she went on to be a partner in a major law firm. And, you know, she never forgot where she came from. She pulled my brother and I up. There were only three of us. So my brother, I went and got a master's degree. Ultimately, my brother became president of a college. So, I really think you're in it for the right reasons, and I'm really happy. And my daughters are happy. I have two daughters, one of whom is not much younger than you are, who keep on saying to me, "Dad, we don't need any more fat white guys in politics, old white guys in politics." You know, and I try not to be offended by that. So they're happy to see young women getting involved too. We're just about out of time here, so why don't you give people your website so that they can go and find out more about you and maybe send you a campaign contribution and support your campaign.
Thank you, absolutely. And I just want to say I'm so happy to be on here with both of you and to be able to have this conversation. And Senator Brown, just so thankful for the work you've done on statehood and how you've been a champion for it. And we're going to get statehood, and it's going to be because of the groundwork and the work that you've done to get us to this place. So thank you so much for that. My website is janeese4dc.com. So that's J-A-N-E-E-S-E and the number 4dc.com. And I would be remiss because both of us recognize, Brooke and I, that, you know, this election is going to come down to people actually being able to request their ballots and then cast their ballots. We're asking people to do their mail-in because we're going from having 122 voting centers to only 20. Voting centers, and we're predominantly asking people to stay safe, especially here in Ward 4, to vote by mail. So please request your ballots. You have until May 26 to request your ballot, and you can go to DC Board of Election, dcboe.org, to request your ballot and do so by May 26, and you can mail it in for the June 2nd primary. So we're trying to get people to don't forget to request the ballot and get out there and vote. And please visit janeese4dc.com to learn more about me. And also you can visit janeese4dc.com/vote to learn about how you can get how you can request your ballot and make sure your vote is counted on election day.
Well, Janeese Lewis George, thank you so much for being on our show. Let me ask you, is your grandmother still with us? Is she still alive?
No, my grandmother is no longer with us.
I'm sorry.
She did. I'm sure
she fed a lot of brown children in her day.
Absolutely. She definitely has. And so many people say, "Oh, I knew your grandmother. I knew your grandmother." And so it is amazing just to hear so many people talk so many great things about her, and you know, recognize she only graduated from middle school. My mom graduated from high school. And so I was, you know, one of the first to graduate from college. And on my law school graduation day, my grandmother was just in tears. And she said, you know, the sacrifice has all been worth it because here, look, it's my granddaughter's graduating from law school today. And so, you know, even though she's not here, I carry that with me and all the value she instilled in me. And so, I'm still carrying her right along with me.
Good. Congratulations.
Well, I'm sure she's very proud. And we're going to leave you with the song tonight. This is my favorite campaign song of all time. It was Huey Long's campaign song, "Every Man a King." So good luck, Denise. And we're
talking
about
that. That's amazing.
Soon.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Take good care. Thank you.
Bye.
We want to thank our listeners for making us a part of your day. We know you have lots of options out there, and we are honored that you listen to BBS Radio and Shadow Politics.
Thanks, Maria.
Thank you, Michael.
Why weep or slumber, America? Castles and clothing and food for all
Give the people their right to vote.